You're listening to The Comedy Cellar, live from the table on the Riotcast Network, riotcast.com.
All right, now I'm starting us off.
All right, good evening, everybody. Welcome to The Comedy Cellar Show here on Sirius XM Channel 99, The Comedy Channel. We're here with, the host of this show, Mr. Dan Natterman.
Co-host, unless I've just been upgraded.
Yes, you've been upgraded. And two comedians we're going to introduce in a second, but I just want to tell you that Dan just starred in a Comedy Cellar presentation of The Godfather.
That is correct.
Where he played Michael Corleone.
You are two for two.
And I have to say, Dan, I was pretty impressed with your acting.
Thank you. Noam. I just was myself. I didn't play Michael Corleone. Just to clarify, this was like a parody of The Godfather that I did with several other comedians here, including Artie Lang, as well as not a comedian, but an actor named Richard Klein, who played Larry in Three's Company.
Yeah, it was pretty.
He was also in the production.
And the best thing about it was that I played the mandolin.
You were in the music. So, I thank you, Noam. It comes naturally to me. I just played me. I played Michael as myself.
All right, let's go.
But I did a nice job.
Let's get this show on the road. Go ahead and introduce the guest, Dan. Go ahead.
Nick Griffin.
Yes.
Here, and he's a regular here at the Comedy Cellar and a regular on this show, in fact. This is not the first time you've come here.
No, it's probably the third. Yeah.
Well, we like having you on.
Well, I mean, that's nice of you to say. I'm always shocked when people are happy.
I feel
to...
like...
Oh, Jesus.
No, I feel like that you and I are on the similar wavelength in many
ways. I believe there's a similar fatigue.
I find you guys on the same wavelength. I think, and Tom Rhodes is also here. Well, he's almost on the opposite wavelength.
Well, I was going to get to Tom, but... But I hadn't finished with Nick.
Go ahead.
Tom Rhodes, who I never see because he's an international comic, which means, I guess, right, Tom, you're all over the world, right?
I have been for a while. I just recently found a place to live.
Well, where'd that place be?
In Los Angeles. I had everything in storage for 10 years. That was a treat to get everything out of storage, see what I've been holding on to.
Yeah.
It was a time capsule of outdated electronics.
Well, where were you prior to
like
being...
nude photos of girlfriends?
Get rid of those.
Like, remember what we had to go through to have naked photos?
I never had a naked photo. Take a roll of film to the drugstore.
These kids now.
I never had
with their digital photography.
I never had naked photo. I guess I wasn't getting laid in the photo era. Now you say, but Dan, you're 46 years old. How's that possible? It's possible.
You're not getting laid in the digital era.
No, I'm getting laid in the digital era. Yes, I am. Not. In great frequency, but...
Anyway...
Think of the photomat people you don't have to deal
intermittently?
With.
Intermittently?
No, did I say intermittently? I said not... I forgot what I said.
Not infrequently.
I said not frequently.
Oh, not frequently.
Yeah.
Well, I want to tell you why I think you guys are on opposite wavelengths.
Please. You mean me and Tom Rhodes?
Nick and Tom... Yeah, the two wings here, because Nick and Tom... Hey, Rick. Nick and Dan... To various degrees, exude kind of a negative energy, right? Like, as part of your acts, you know, kind of like, but it's not an act. It's also like, you know, kind of a.
But Nick does it in kind of the like kind of brooding, like poet, kind of like, you know, like you can see like something creative is kind of going on.
He's one of my favorite comics. I'm saying that these guys are introspective and they're thinking about things and they don't exude happiness. I don't mean to insult anybody.
It's not as you can imagine. It's not the first time.
Even if nobody had ever told you that, you must had some idea that
sure,
you're not skipping and jumping. And Tom Rhodes just has this aura of like. You know, and I don't know if it's true or not. Just like you know, like confidence and happy with himself and ready. You know,
yeah, I would.
Wake
I would
up each day
that, yeah.
and happiness. You know.
Well, how well do you know Tom?
It's all going to work out.
I'm talking all aura here, Dan. I don't know.
You're just, but I never see the guy. I see him once in a blue moon, so I don't have a good read on him.
But I'm in a good mood when I come around, Dan.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess you are. It's just been so long. You're in L.A. now. Before that, you were.
I didn't live anywhere for 10 years. I had everything in storage, and I just traveled the world as a comedian.
So how does that work?
So I would do like 6 months of the year out of the country, and 6 months relentlessly all over the U.S. and Canada. Last year, I did 5 months in Europe, a month in Asia. My wife is from Holland. She's been traveling with me for 8 years.
I know that.
He has a high Indian wife.
So when we had time off, the last 4 years in a row, we went to Rome and rented an apartment for a couple weeks.
That's what I was going to ask.
Sleepinitaly.com. Love it. 2 years ago, I did a month in Asia, and then we went to Bali for a couple weeks. So depending where we were in the world, we would get a... We lived everywhere, basically.
And you got tired of that?
No.
So why did you finally get an address?
I don't know. To just be... I've been working on a book for about 3 years, and I'm trying to come up with my next hour for my next hour special. So kind of just to focus on writing and whipping it together.
I don't know. I couldn't do it.
But you did live for a time in Holland.
5 years. I lived in Amsterdam.
So you actually had an apartment and you were in one place.
Yeah, I lived here in New York, 98, 99. And then 2000, I moved to Amsterdam.
Living in Amsterdam, you realize where your limits are. I used to think I was really open-minded about things. Fuck that. I got limits. I went to a sex club in Amsterdam. This girl comes out dressed like the Grim Reaper. Death. She had a sickle and everything. She put down a circle cloth on a stage and had a devil pentagram star on it. She stripped naked, flipped upside down on the devil star, put a candle in her thingy-mahoo, lit the candle on fire, and then she did this breakdancing where, like, her legs were going all these different directions, and the fucking candle never moved, man. And the flame never went out. I'm sorry, that is beyond my Christian sensibilities. Okay? That is too far for me, mister. I'm going back to that club one day. I'm gonna get a squirt gun full of holy water. I'm gonna jump out from behind the seats and pop, pop! We're gonna get some Jesus into that girl, even if it's one drop at a time, in her satanic little butthole, okay? A little Jesus for you. Pop, pop! A lot of my European friends tell me they think all Americans own guns and that we're all easily prone to violence. And I just want to shoot them in the face when they say shit like that, man. It's just so unfair to blanket me. Jesus. And I just moved back to the United States, man. I'm in culture shock. It's like a foreign country to me there. It's weird, man. Nobody eats bread anymore. Everybody's on a low-carb diet. Really, people go to McDonald's and they just get the meat patty in. They don't eat bread. Jesus said, take this bread and eat it. It is my body. And the disciples said, Jesus, we're all on low-carb diets. We appreciate you dying for our sins, but we're all trying to slim down a little bit. We want to look good in the paint tank. Technology's so much more advanced now, man. A friend of mine has a camera phone. Have you seen these things? They're amazing. And my friend showed me on his camera phone, he's got pictures of his girlfriend. He's got close-ups of her cookie and pictures of her blowing him. And I'm like, wow, you can do so many things with those. I've got to get a girlfriend. What an entertainment package they are. You can bend them and lick them and take them places. There is no limit to the amount of fun you can have with a girl.
Get Juskow in here.
Yeah, sure.
Tom, do you know Juskow? Do you know Dave Juskow? I thought everybody
knew. Yeah, of course.
Dave, do you know Tom Rhodes?
I do very
well.
Hey,
Dave, how are you,
bro? Nice to see you again. You don't need a place to stay, right?
Sorry, not this time.
How are you? Do you remember me at all from the 90s?
Where did we hang out at?
Catch a Rising Star.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, years ago.
Belzer brought me in.
We even went to a Mets game together.
Oh, my God.
You were so high. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have.
David.
You're not holding that against me, are you?
No, never. I was too.
So let me tell you about
nice
Dave.
Nice to see you.
Dave Juskow. You were a stand-up comic?
Yeah, back in the 90s.
In the 90s. And you were on Star Search.
I would say the 70s.
But Dave Juskow came to my attention because he's like the single most beloved human in the stand-up comedy.
I don't know whether you'd know that
community.
From Tom's reaction. I'm not so sure.
He is very beloved.
I mean, everybody loves this guy, and having dealt with him now a little bit, I can see why. He's just one of those. And Rick Crome is here too. You agree with that assessment?
I wholeheartedly. He's like our own special special crazy cousin.
So he's done these shows. First of all, he loves The Godfather. Yeah. Do you like The Godfather, Tom?
Who doesn't?
I mean, I'm a huge Godfather fan, and he's a huge Godfather. So he's been doing these Godfather parodies, and he's getting heavy hitters like Jeff Ross and David Tell and Paul Mercurial. And
I saw that coming. I heard it.
Well, tonight we had...
No, yeah. And Artie Lang.
Dan Natterman.
I mean, people who don't leave their house for less than real sums of money are coming down... Rehearsing, doing, and I don't know if you pay them anything, but there's no 20, money.
Everybody gets $20.
Yeah, there's no.
I have to pay you.
I haven't got my $20.
For real?
That's all right.
No.
I
don't know who I love.
That ought to fill you with tremendous pride, like as a person, to know that people like you that much, that they're going to come do this thing for $20. It's a real effort.
I guess I'm one of those people that just does. I'm just like, everybody hates me. I feel like Charlie Brown.
No, they don't hate you. Sarah
Silverman.
No,
they love you. We all love you.
I feel bad. Yeah. I wish I could pay more. I was just doing what I got the idea from Tom Papa.
Well, how much can you pay with what you're getting paid?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So I just want I want everybody to get something, you know?
No, I don't think we do it for the money. It's just
right.
It's gratuitous. I didn't even know there was money. I just did it because
I apologize. I was giving it. You came later, and I was just giving it to everybody sitting down.
It's all right. It'll be taken out in sexual favors of some sort or another.
If Paul Mercurio called Jeff Ross, Artie Lang, and said, "Listen, I want to do the Godfather set. I want you to come for $20. What do you think would happen, Paul?
I think
First of all, I would never get their numbers. They wouldn't even allow me.
That's right.
Artie gave up a big paying gig just because he really wanted to do it.
Yeah, and do you know Tom? Do you know Artie Lang?
Oh yeah, of course, for years.
I mean, he is just unbelievable.
He was perfect.
He was wonderful.
He did
tonight.
It exactly the way it's supposed to be from the movie. Yeah,
I think he could play dramatic roles.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's exactly what I was thinking when I was listening to him. I'm like, he's such a good actor. Yeah, he was excellent. Yeah, I'm surprised sometimes when the people don't know how it's supposed to be said. Like, from if you know the movie, I'm surprised more of the guys don't really...
It didn't seem like the people who did the show
knew
the movie.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, yeah. It's okay, but I just, sometimes I assume the boys are going to know more,
Anyway, so when are we doing the next one?
August 2nd.
August 2nd.
Are you in?
You need mandolin?
Always. You were amazing. Always.
How awesome was a mandolin?
That was fantastic.
The music was incredible tonight, Dom.
Do you know
one of the characters. You know the movie. Do one of the characters.
Yeah, but do you know that if you searched to find a mandolin player who could play all the themes from The Godfather, including the Tarantino, you couldn't even find someone?
No, absolutely not.
And I actually already knew them because I love the movie that much.
And your friend was amazing, too. Was I mean, really, hey, Colin.
Dave, give him my $20 because he was...
I wasn't sure if
I should... You had now, in this episode, as I mentioned earlier, Richard Klein...
From Three's Company.
I guess he went home. He's not here.
For a while. He took some pictures.
He did a
really good job, too. He did much better than he did in the rehearsal.
He did. There was only one thing I didn't like, but I don't know if you want me to say it in the...
Please, go ahead.
Okay. Rick knows what I'm going to say. I didn't like the guy who played the gay character. Was that Paulie?
I wasn't happy with that either.
You weren't happy with that?
No.
And this is interesting.
The actor was amazing.
Rick, don't defend.
I don't know.
This is what I think. And this has to be an interesting conversation.
That's my fault because I made it that way.
He wrote Paulie as, and Paulie's the guy who is the guy who was a traitor and ends up getting Marlon Brando killed, and then he gets killed. And he wrote him as a flamboyant gay guy.
Yeah.
Which is in this day and age risky already.
Yeah.
And then you cast a flamboyant gay guy to play the part. And I thought that was you being afraid. Like, I would have cast Barnes to do it.
No, I was. I never think of him as gay because he also does. He did Johnny Fontaine and he plays the old man. So I don't. He's not really that flamboyant to me. But
with those pants he was wearing, his normal outfit or that was a costume?
No, it's his normal outfit.
All right, he was wearing like skin tight. But that was.
He's gay, but he's not over. He's not. Completely flaming.
Yeah, I made a mistake because I should have just done it myself because I knew exactly how I wanted to do it. And I should have. I don't know why. I got confused because I get killed. I play Don Corleone and I get killed in the middle. And I should have given myself another part because then I know how the flow of the thing goes. So I was a little disappointed.
Okay, but there's something that is funny that's not... it's not so well accepted anymore, but it's funny to see a man dressed up as a woman. It's funny to see a woman dressed up as a man, and it's funny to see a straight guy play a flamboyant gay
character. I didn't even want him to be gay. I just thought it was funny that he just kind of was effeminate and I just thought the gag was he's just pretending like everything's okay. Yeah. When we know he's gonna get killed. I thought that was funny. You're right. I was very disappointed.
It's not very disappointed.
It ruined my night.
I just worried if and you guys may want to speak in is just how much has the threat of offending and political correctness just infected everybody's comedy and everybody's decisions about what they do?
I don't know. That's true.
It must be worse in Europe, no?
I haven't been to Europe in a couple of years, so I don't know. But no.
And you're pretty, I don't know what the word is. What's the word?
Risque.
He's pretty.
Edgy. Edgy, that's what they say.
Oh, I see.
Well, like in Holland, they like dark humor.
They like dark humor.
Yeah. And England, yeah, it's you know.
Do you have to tone it down when you come to America now?
In like the middle parts sometimes.
Have you had people get angry?
Yeah, I mean, I had a woman get angry the other day. I was at the Met, and I took a photo. It was a Caravaggio of Christ and Virgin Mary, and I just tweeted, me personally, I would have given Christ a bigger cock. And some woman got really pissed, and like, you know, I'm sorry, you know, the my savior's got a big fucking donkey cock and it's beautiful, and you know, if I'd have been around 300 years ago when the guy was painting it, I would have been over his shoulder going, you're gonna add a little more paint there, right?
You'd have to get Rick out of the way, but
I think
roller or brush.
America's probably more politically correct than in many ways than Europe. Certainly America's more religious than Europe. America, you know, there's more fundamentalist Christians in America than there are in Europe.
Wait. Yeah, a lot of people are mostly atheist in Europe. And then hardcore
because this was essentially a play of some kind. It didn't that political correctness concern never entered my head with him doing that super gay flamboyant. Whether or not it fit within the motif of what you wanted it to be is a different thing, but that it's an interesting point that you raised, Noam, well, it didn't hit.
Incorrect, but I wondered if he didn't say, well, I want to write a gay cat, let me make sure I get a gay guy to do it that way.
I didn't care at all. I was just looking for
something. I'm inoculated, you know?
I didn't even think of that for a second. In fact, actually, I said I forgot he was gay, and then I was like, oh, you know, do you have a problem doing this? I wouldn't have cared who it was. I mean, as long as they were able to do it. He, in the first one, he did the photographer, you know, at the wedding.
Oh, yeah.
And he
throws $20, Sonny throws $20
at him. No, the guy that's actually taking the portrait we just made, he goes, we're not doing anything until Michael comes. He goes, darn it, I was trying to cut out early. And from that,
like Paul
that's why, yeah, exactly. So that's why I thought of it, because he just did it that way for that one line, and that's the only reason.
And by the way, Rick, who is
gay. A gay American. Yeah.
Gay American. He has, you know, Rick was a Republican when I met him.
Is that right?
And well, I was center. I was.
You were
center
a Republican.
Right. Well, yeah, I was.
Okay.
But not when I met you. I kind of.
You veered. Right.
I was veering that way during the Clinton administration.
But now he's kind of a member of the prissy left.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
The prissy left.
I never think of him as gay either.
And he has a lot of sympathy.
Not as anybody I'm trying to get.
He does, like, he does not like, he. I'm not sure how you make your decision, but when someone's like playing a gay character as gay, he scrutinizes it very closely, and it can go either way with you.
Well, sure.
How do you decide?
Well, I think that tonight's portrayal, if we're talking about that specifically, was so over the top in a kind of a clownish way, and it was not done in a hostile way. The character wasn't self-loathing. He was just very, very effeminate. In a very macho situation, and that juxtaposition was funny, and I didn't find it offensive at all. I just thought the timing of this actor, what's his name again?
Mateo,
it was just brilliant. So I don't know, because I am, you're right, Noam, I am a little scrutinous. You know, if let's say if it's a straight guy doing a, you know, the gay guy impression, hi there, I'm going to. And it's all to say, you know, all gay guys talk like this, and he winds up getting, you know, some sort of a horrible thing happened to him or something. Let me tell you something.
If that guy playing that gay character today had been gay, I mean, had been straight, playing it exactly the same way, Rick would not have liked it.
You're probably right.
That makes sense. I'll
be honest with you. I would have think that was. I might have thought it. I wouldn't have hated it. Because it was such a brilliant portrayal, but
it would have made you uncomfortable.
You know, it would have made me uncomfortable.
Now that I think about it, we also had that other gay part with Luca Brasi, where we mentioned that most, you know, mafia guys are homophobic. We were talking about that, you know, but we had that thing where he makes a pass at Bruno Tattaglia. So we did address that the mob doesn't, you know, that kind of stuff. Or I was trying to be politically correct in that sense.
May I just say that that character did not talk about sexuality at all.
Right.
This
he just
character.
Had the voice.
He was just the effeminate voice. So it wasn't even like, here's a gay guy and here's how he sounds like. He was just being very effeminate. So
that was the plan, just to be Paul Lynn. You know,
by the way, and Rick, if you don't want to delve into this, you can just shoot it down. But Rick confided in me earlier today that his sex life has never been better.
Never been better.
And he's—I don't want to reveal his age, but he's not.
I'm 59 years old.
Wow! And you're saying the party it just keeps going.
Well, first of all, he has medical technology.
Yes, thank God. it ain't all me.
Well, he has medical technology. He also has computer technology on his side, which we didn't have in back in the day.
All of a sudden, look at me. I'm a type. I'm a silver daddy.
Is that what it's called?
I've got silver hair, and I'm an older
silver
gay guy,
like a fox.
I'm right. A silver fox, and I'm a type. And now those younger fellas who like older fellas I'm beating them off with this. Well, I'm beating them off.
Hello.
Gay sex is a total mystery to me. Anybody else here besides Rick ever had a gay experience?
Well, no, wait a minute.
What do you call tonight?
I can't even imagine how they relate to
each
other.
Listen, this is what I say. I say, listen, I got gray hair, I got a big dick, I've been on TV, and I can pay for dinner. I'm irresistible.
And Tom, since you're the most unusual guest, you're not around. I want to jump in on. But when you're with a woman, no matter what, even if you're like a not so masculine guy like me, and you have it, it's still clear who the man and the woman is. She lays in your arm. Like it's just the script is clear.
Yeah.
When you have two men, I don't understand. Like, do you bump heads? Do you trade off?
Is it not if you're doing it right? I mean, be bumping heads.
How do you decide?
Do you want to be treated like a this sounds flippant, but I don't mean like, do you want to be treated like a lady? Do you want to be treated like a man? What goes on?
Oh my God, we're getting into the technical aspects of gay sex. You mean like who's the bottom if you're fucking, and who decides who that is?
Oh my God, where did that come from?
I mean, that's what you said.
That actually is a question I would like addressed.
Let me ask you this, Dan. You ever kiss a man like really hard on the mouth?
You gotta go on?
Soon, yeah.
Do you have anything on the gay experience you want to talk about?
It always happens this way, Tom. They get into the gay stuff and they can't get off.
You must have quite a lot of gay men.
No, I mean it's interesting to. I mean, if any one of us was put on the spot over our sex life, you know, like the specifics of it.
You know, I mean, what if you're with a dominant woman who wants to be on top all the time?
You know who is there tonight?
She's still a woman.
Liza Minnelli's publicist came to the show tonight. He's the most flaming.
Why
he loved it.
Why letting Rick off the hook? And I wasn't talking about penetration, although that's certainly worth talking about. I'm just saying the way you relate to each other.
I don't know if it's a physical thing. It's to me, I'm more interested in terms of the relationship, who is more the husband, like more the dominant one. I don't mean physically dominant, but like
I think in any relationship you have somebody who's there's always somebody saying let's do this and another person saying yes dear, whether the straight people or gay people. So that's just a natural dynamic that happens. You know, somebody becomes more of a dominant in it in the relationship, but it's not like there's a role thing. Okay, today you be the husband, that kind of thing. Ask me another question. I'm not sure exactly how to.
Do you find yourself the dominant man in one relationship and then kind of the submissive guy in the next relationship?
Sure. You can get a personality. Like, I was in one relationship where I was the person who was always looking to satisfy the other person's need. You know, what movie do you want to go to? You know, should we paint the wall this color? Is this all right with you? And I lose myself in the relationship. So, and it was, I think, basically out of a fear of argument. You know what? You know I don't like to argue. So
not when you're sober. Not when you're not drinking yet.
Yeah, and I haven't been drinking for 2 years.
By the way, what about the transgender bathrooms? Anybody?
Hey, I'm 2.5.
Oh, thank you.
I don't like those.
You're 2.5?
Wait, Tommy, you're sober as well?
Yeah, 2.5 years.
2.5 years?
I blacked out in Philadelphia, fell off of a bar stool. See this scar there?
Ah, nice.
Yeah. 6 digits.
That was your rock bottom. Do you post your sober anniversaries on Facebook? I see that. One of the more common Facebook posts.
No, he's a man.
Yeah, no, and I'm a year off the cigarettes. Yeah. I was two packs a day. Always been a heavy drinker my whole life. So I feel like I kind of just joined the human race recently.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I need a drink.
And I put William McGoffin, every year he posts his sober anniversary.
I know. I said he's a man. That's why.
But he doesn't say what it is. He said, 3 years ago today, my life changed. And every year I write the same thing. I comment, what do you mean? What the hell are you talking about?
Well, thanks to me. I told him he was doing drugs the wrong way.
Yeah.
And then he actually went into rehab. Now he starts running one. The guy that used to run.
All right, Noam is chomping at the bit.
No, no, because I know he's got to go on.
Yeah.
Do you worry? Have you read about the cognitive damage that alcohol? Like I was drinking a lot every day while I was playing music.
Yeah.
And then I read an article that apparently, you know, you get like a kind of alcohol dementia,
uh-huh.
not from drinking even all that much. And it scared the shit out of me because I have trouble remembering names and all kinds of stuff.
I just saw some news piece that said like Advil and Advil PM and these kind of flu and cold medicines shrink your brain.
Really?
Well,
and leads to early stages of dementia. And there's no test of like how much you've taken in a lifetime. I only saw one news thing, but I'm like, oh shit.
Well, the good news,
right?
The good news is for Noam is that a monkey could run this place. You know, so he doesn't. I mean, let's face it. You know, it's on autopilot.
That's not what. That's supposed to make me happy.
It could be worse.
Can I tell one story about your dad before I leave?
Please do.
Manny was such a funny guy, man. And the stories. There's one great story I remember. He told me about from the Cafe Wa when Bob Dylan was coming around. Hated him.
Yeah, he hated
Manny hated Dylan. Hated his voice, hated his songs. And he said he couldn't even stay in the same room when Dylan would go on stage. And he said he thought to himself whenever he'd see Dylan, this guy's never going to make it.
it's absolutely true, and it's even deeper than that. First of all, if I wanted to listen to a Bob Dylan record, I had to make sure my father didn't catch me. And when Blowin' in the Wind came out, which was inarguable, it was a good song. You had to acknowledge it was a good
song.
My father would, he said, I don't believe he wrote it. He said, he did not write
that. I feel similar about Hall & Oates.
Yeah, but what about the times they are changing? That's an undeniably great song.
He didn't know that song.
Desolation Row.
No, he knew the really, really commercial Dylan song. And even he might have known times, but Blown in the Wind, I'm Older, was a special hit.
Room.
It was covered by everybody, every campfire.
Civil rights anthem,
right.
Baby.
Civil rights anthem, that's right.
Can't you see that the waters around you have grown?
All of our temple
that's
classes.
Not bad.
Well, how come we couldn't do that today in the show?
I'm sorry, Tom. I'd like to talk to you some more. I'm sorry you have to go.
No, it's okay. You scheduled me. I have to go on stage.
No, I know. I'm
sorry you have to go.
I don't know you very well at all, but I always find you to be a very interesting guy. And I know there's a lot going on there, and you know.
Except the tune.
No chance to talk to you.
You'll be drenched to the bone.
Thanks for having me.
And we have Indian wives, you know, in common.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Anyway.
And so do I.
Back to the being a bottom brick.
Nice to see you, Tom.
Great seeing you, Rick.
I haven't seen Tom for 10 years or so.
And your waters around you, hey, raging.
You know, I'm the world's biggest Dan Natterman fan.
As am I.
And this
I was the first.
You guys will have to fight it out.
Was I not the first?
You were certainly early on the train.
That's right. I even wrote a song called Natterman's Down.
Did you really?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, he did
introduced
write
that. It. Yeah, with my band.
Do you have a recording of it?
I think I do.
If you could get it, tonight, we'll cut it into
the show. I can sing it right for you. One second. Come gather around, people. Wherever you roam.
I don't know. It was about Natterman's Down, sign on the line. Natterman's Down. I don't know.
So
have a copy.
What I'm wondering, because one chapter
the
is
Godfather there. That's my Norm MacDonald impression. Hey, the Godfather there, you know. This is what happens to me after I drink half a glass of Hennessy, you know?
That's what it is. The next chapter is Michael Corleone Intensive, correct?
Yes. You mean at the hospital?
Yeah.
It's Michael Corleone. I see what you're saying. Yeah, the next one goes from the hospital scene. I'm trying to think of what I call. Oh, I called it Captain McCluskey Tries the Veal.
Dan's got to shoot McCluskey in the next.
He does shoot McCluskey, and you're absolutely right. Yes, you've got in the bathroom. That we'll have to get a serious actress. You know what I'm talking about.
Please, get someone to show her tits. Please.
No, it's going to happen.
Please.
You know what? I knew this perfect girl, too, who
would
totally
do it. You're talking about Apollonia?
Yeah.
And you need those strange, elongated tits that's etched in our minds.
Those perfect ones.
You're hearing it now in
I'll
Radio
never
Lab
forget
tits.
When I saw that, and she opened it up. I'm like, there it is. Because you've been waiting, you know.
I feel bad. Nick Griffin, by the way, kind of left quietly. He felt, I guess.
He did the exact same thing on Brennan's show yesterday.
You know, I do feel bad. I hope he's not thinking, oh, well, we didn't appreciate him, because we certainly did.
He thought that yesterday, too, on the Brennan Attell Hour.
We love him.
He waved me over, and he said, here, sit down. I'm leaving, so.
All right.
He gets it. He's cool.
Yeah, he's cool. That's all he had to say.
All right, so you had a question about penetration for... Juskow told me a story that he was almost the third wheel after Dave Chappelle and Neil Brennan on the Chappelle Show. But Dave Attell...
ruined everything.
You want to tell that? Can you tell that story?
You're like the Pete Best of comedy.
Yeah.
This is an amazing story.
Well, Neil Brennan was a big fan of Dave Juskow.
I always liked Dave Attell up until this book.
Yeah. Dave Attell, when he was drinking in his days, when it was his birthday, he would come here, we'd all get drunk, and we'd laugh hysterically when he was on stage. And then one time, Chappelle was on early, and he wouldn't get off, you know, the way Chappelle is. And Attell was just yelling at him from the stage to get off, and they got into a huge fight. The next day, Attell called me, he goes, why did you call the New York Post?
And it was like, something in page 6 about it.
Yeah, it was in page, I guess. I didn't know. He just goes, why you call the Post? And I'm like, hey, I do things that I feel like doing, you know, whatever the way the wind takes. I was just kidding. And I don't know what he's talking about. And then he's like, why did you call the Post? And I'm like, I didn't call. I don't know what you're talking about. I wouldn't even know how to get in touch with the Post. This is years ago before there was internet or anything.
Right.
And apparently there was an article about Chappelle and Attell getting into a huge fight at the Comedy Cellar. And he got so angry, he told Chappelle. And Neil had called me and said, we're doing a pilot called The Chappelle Show. We want you to be heavily involved with this, because Neil was a big fan of mine. Apparently, I influenced somehow. And then I was never on the show, because apparently I found out about a year ago the reason was because I called The Post, which I never did, because Attell told Chappelle this.
Oh, my God.
Attell told Chappelle
but this is,
that
by the
just
way,
got called The Post, and Chappelle just crossed him off the list.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. This, by the way, is one of the reasons Dave, you mentioned how beloved Dave is. How do you not love a guy that just becomes close to success on so many occasions and it never, you know,
it's
it
true.
Never comes to
but
fruition?
But there's a flip side to that, too. It's like I've told so many people they're not going to make it, and I think they make it in spite of me. Like I told Jim Gaffigan he was the worst actor I've ever seen, and I said he's not going to make it as an actor. This is like,
why would you
15,
tell him that?
Because this is what I do.
Well, he has
to
ask you?
Tell people that.
He hasn't, no. But he's not.
He
made
was in
it
one of my shows, and I was just like, I'm like, listen, you're a horrible actor. You're a very good comedian. You're a horrible actor. You're not going to make it. So I went back to see him on his Broadway show, and apologized. This 15 years later, I went back, and he was.
Did
doing
he remember?
Broadway. No, of course he remembers. Yeah, we're good now. We're really good. But for a long time, it was bad because I tell people this. I don't know. So the worst
he
one.
He won't play here.
Is that right?
I don't know why. Rick might know why.
I think that were you using him like he feels you should have when he was before he was a name?
Yeah, he holds grudges.
If you weren't,
but
using
he hasn't
him,
to me, so he might. You could get it over.
If you weren't using him a lot when he was not famous, then yeah, and he's gonna be pissed at you.
Well, now we're very close, actually.
It may have been that he wasn't being used a lot when he was famous, and he thought, well,
no, if he was famous, they use him a lot.
Between him and
me,
I don't like your tone, Dan. But all right.
No, said,
I told Chelsea Handler, I knew her since she was 12. She's like, Jessica, how can I get into comedy? I'm like, when she was 22, I was like, kid. You're not going to make it in comedy. I mean, I must have told her 100. I laughed in her face.
And she didn't. She made it as a talk show host.
Well, whatever. She still made it. It was unbelievable.
Who else did you say wouldn't
make it?
The
Blue Man Group is the best example of all time. I knew them.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I met them. I knew them, and I knew hey, my roommates do this thing where you got to meet them, and I met them, and they're like, yeah, they do this. They paint themselves blue, and I'm like, I'm going to stop you right there. This is a huge... You guys are wasting your time. So then I met, you know... I remember me and my friend walk out of that house and we're just like laughing. What a bunch of jerk-offs. That's the loserest thing. So then I go to see the show, you know, after, and it was just like, that wasn't that bad.
Not that bad.
I actually took Sarah Silverman like on a date, I think. Just, I'm like, yeah, my friends do. Once they made it, I was like, yeah, my friend, I know these guys. Yeah. Oh, they're great. I told them they're going to make it. But those guys are so nice. So nice that they totally forgave me, and I went down, and they were like, help us with the show, help us. They're the nicest guys, and I don't know if you know their story.
You punched up the Blue Man Group?
I gave them some pointers. Well, wait, the best story is that I
you
did
said
David Copperfield. I know David Copperfield since I was like 8, because he was my camp counselor.
The magician?
And was, yeah.
But and is that his real name, Copperfield?
No, it's David Kotkins.
Okay.
We're from the same neighborhood. So when I was like 8 or 5, and he was 13, he was my counselor, and he was doing magic at a girl's party, and I'm like, what are you doing here? He goes, I do magic. I'm like, oh, you do magic. And he finished the show, and he goes, and I guess the reason,
like Forrest Gump in a way.
I know. And I think the reason I remember it so well was because he came up to me after and asked my advice. And I was the only person he knew. He goes, everybody was going to get ice cream, and I didn't care for ice cream, so we talked. And he goes, what do you think of the act? And I'm like, I don't know if it'd end with the balloon animals. I don't know if that's. So I gave him advice.
You're bullshitting.
No, I'm not. I swear I'm not bullshitting. I gave
him
advice.
How old are you?
Like seven?
He asked a seven-year-old for advice.
That's what I'm saying, because he was. That's why I remember it, because he asked us. He was only 13. You know, and then so then the next day, this is why I remember too. The next day in camp, we were on the bus together, and he goes, "Oh, I saw David Saturday night at a party," and the guys in my book, they're like, "You hung out with the counselor? You hung out with Copperfield?" You know, and I'm like, "We were at a party together. It wasn't a big. I mean, it was very exciting for me, but I did tell him that some of his tricks were not as good as they could have been."
This is why we love Dave Juskow. This was one of the most fascinating stories I've ever
heard.
Those
are great stories.
The last three things that you just said.
That's in one column. And the other column, has there been anybody that you did have faith in that other people didn't that actually made it?
No, not one.
Not one.
I mean, it's like people always ask me, did you say that to Attell? Did you say that to Sarah? And I'm like, no, we knew that. I mean, I've known Attell since 1987, and there was no... We knew it was going to be. He was hilarious from day one.
No,
there was
he wasn't.
No way. You don't think so? Oh, well, right. You didn't think so either.
Dave Attell was one of my late nighters when I ran late night.
I know, but for me, I just knew. I just knew. I'm sorry.
This is the story. I told you before, Dan.
That's right.
My father. You know, I wasn't around there, but my father would have waitress meetings, and he would ask the waitresses, what's going on with the late night comedians?" And Attell was clearing the room, and my father said, "That's it, Esty. No more Attell."
Esty wasn't involved at that time.
Or that was
whoever. He said, that's it, Rick.
That's it, no more tell. And
come
Julia
on, no.
Waller, who was the waitress, who worked, said, do you remember? Were you actually here?
She says, I was here.
She says, no, Manny, he's a genius. Don't do that. He's a genius.
Yeah.
And my father loved this waitress, Julia.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He had the highest regard for her.
Wow.
Because she said that. He said, all right, if Julia says it, then we'll wait a little bit longer. And then pretty quickly... He got all the everything together.
You know, for me, I just knew
he
at the beginning.
He didn't suck it along.
I remember.
Well, no, Dave. I mean, the story. Dave used to go to NYU, and he would hang out and sit in the back of the room until midnight, and he had three jokes. One of them ending with, "You know, you've had too much to drink when you find yourself being tit fucked by a guy named Lumpy."
Oh, I don't remember that. I remember
you've had too many
drinks when you get pulled over by the Coast Guard.
That's later.
That was the second
later.
One.
Oh, that was later.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but he emulated Colin Quinn at the time.
That's right. That's right.
And
that was his hero.
Colin had nine jokes, and Attell used to end his sentence with "folks." Folks.
That's right.
But do you remember that?
Yeah, of course.
Before he became Dave Attell, who we know now, he was emulating Colin Quinn.
That's right.
Can I ask you guys
a question? And Dan actually might like this. Yeah. You know, they say, well, I'll go around just one word answer. What's the number of years you think somebody needs to develop into a good stand-up comic? How many years?
A good stand-up comic? Seven.
Too many, because by the time you're any good, you're dismissed as old.
I say
but,
it's different.
Well, I'm not finished, though.
Sorry.
That's a good one-word answer, Dan. Go ahead.
Well, I didn't know you asked for a one-word answer.
Because you weren't listening. Because when it comes to music, like if you say it takes 10 years to get good at an instrument, intuitively, even if you don't play, you kind of understand that. You watch somebody play an instrument, and you see that skill, and you say, holy shit, right? But then what takes 7 years to go from, like, Colin Quinn, who had nine jokes? Like, what happens in that 7 years that all of a sudden he's a fantastic comedian? Like, what skills are you developing?
If you just get back to my point, the definition of fantastic has changed. The bar has been raised. So
wherever you want to put the bar, I'm just saying what clicks with a comic? It's not a physical skill. It's jokes, but, I mean, how hard is it to say something funny? Like I'm saying as a layman, like, what goes on? Do you even know? Is it your mic's not plugged in?
Yeah. Paul Mercurio is going to join us now.
Always the narrator.
I'm always the narrator.
Or is it just magic and you can't explain it?
No, I think what happens is I agree with Dan, but the Tonight Show meant something then, and that's why people became stars. I think that's part of it. And I think seven could be right, but I think it depends on what you're doing for those 7 years. I think if you're on the road and in the city, I think you get stronger faster. I think the answer to your question for me personally is I think comics at seven, eight, or whatever the number is, start to not feel like they have to do stuff just to make people laugh, but to do stuff that they want to talk about. And that comes from confidence, being on stage, and being able to just be yourself on stage. And when you break through that wall, then you become unique, and then hopefully you become a star.
You develop a point of view.
Yes.
Is but that I what think it in is? The beginning, you have to I find think, your point
I,
of view.
I think so.
But Attell always had his point of view, right? Sorry.
He didn't always have the point of view, but he was all. When he first started, he was absurd, but as he got, angrier, but as that hostility came out,
that's good.
It came from a point of view. It made it twice as funny.
Yeah, you're right. You agree with that, Paul? Exactly right.
So
about Attell.
I'm sorry, who were we talking about?
Attell. Oh,
yeah, Attell. No, I agree, but I remember Attell early on. Like all of us doing fairly surface jokes that kind of you heard before, because I think you're just it's so freaky to be up there that you want to do stuff that pleases people, and then after a while you go, fuck it, I'm going to do what I want to do. And Dave became pretty absurd pretty quickly, but you know, he was doing pretty standard stuff in the beginning, but then he made a turn and, you know, became
when did
Dave.
You tell Louis he was never going to make it, Dave?
Early on, 1990.
Did you think Louis was going to make it?
Yeah, we were all pretty sure Louis was pretty
see,
cool.
See, now
is
I
that
find
true?
This thing with Louis to be really interesting, because he was super absurd.
Yeah, he was an absurd.
And then he turned the corner. He tells the story.
That's
he
what was, made me think about it, because Louis was, had nothing to do with what he does now.
He tells the story that he was sitting at the Kowloon Restaurant Comedy Club up in Saugus, Massachusetts, and had an epiphany or a breakdown in a car, like, I gotta really do something else. And now he's... I don't want to say Justin, that it's insignificant, but he's doing something really simple. He's talking about his life and how things affect him. And while that's really good, that's kind of what all stand-ups are supposed to do.
Dan doesn't do that, though.
I don't do that.
I disagree. I think if you listen to Dan and he talks about sort of his trying to get relationships with women and this and that, I think through his material you get a sense of it.
No, you get a sense of it.
I don't mean that as an insult.
I'm not taking it as an insult. But I'm not keeping it real, if you will. And Noam says he encourages me to do it. I don't know what he means by that. If he encourages me to throw away all the material I have,
I think you have a point of view.
Dave Attell doesn't do that either. So would you say that he should do it?
I don't think we know anything about Dave Attell's personal life or Jerry Seinfeld's personal life.
And Jerry doesn't do it either.
Because they're doing observational stuff, but they're doing it from a
or
from
misdirection.
A, point of view.
A lot of misdirection.
But that personal life thing is what makes. Like a really great comic. I mean, what is all the people that are current? I mean, it's the personal life that people want to hear more.
Yeah, but I don't think it's either or. I think that both styles are valid.
That's true too.
But I will agree with you that it seems to be that the more personal and the more heartfelt it is now, the more people are drawn to it these days.
But even Pryor went through it. You look at him in 68 and 69 on The Tonight Show in a suit and tie. Yeah.
Sure.
It was real, like, friendly, easy stuff. And then. You know, that episode that he had in Vegas with a big white audience, and he went out and he said, fuck it, and he dropped the mic and he walked out, and then he started working small clubs, and he turned into the Pryor that everybody revered.
Right.
I think everybody goes through that process.
Everybody said I would have been a... Everybody tells me when I was doing comedy that I needed to be more about myself, tell, like, more stuff, and I just can't seem to do it. I just never want to hide behind imitations.
But I want to pay you a compliment.
Stuff is not true.
Exactly.
I want to pay you a compliment, Dave, because you always discount how funny you are. He did a great set tonight that truly reflected you. Like, I believe that you run around your house and do impressions of kids.
No, I do that.
I know, but to say that people don't get a sense of you from that, I think you're wrong.
I'm branching out now. It's like when I was doing it more, I was only doing imitations, kind of hiding behind them, and I remember I did one of those Aspen one-person shows, and that guy Lucian from the comic strip came out one time, and he goes, "Well, we've gotten to see a little bit more of Dave Juskow this time, you know."
So
that's how you get more better.
A lot of times people tell young comics, "We want to hear more about you," but as we said, Dave Attell doesn't talk really about himself. Neither does. Stephen Wright never did that. Ronnie Dangerfield never did that.
Exceptions, just like
Jerry Rickles. Exceptions. I'm talking about half of the Jerry Seinfeld didn't do that.
Well, you're talking about the people, like people that tell and Rickles, Dangerfield. They all have like one. They're one-liner guys.
Yeah,
that's like kind of different, though, right?
And it's hard to build a TV show around that character.
Well, forget about a TV show. I'm saying as a comic. It's not wrong to do...
Nothing is wrong.
You know, Woody Allen did his whole thing about the moose. There's nothing about Woody Allen, the real Woody Allen, in any of that. And that was one of the greatest, considered, I think, by many comics,
well, that's
one
true,
of the greatest...
But also, like, with Attell, like you're saying, you still do... You don't really getting involved, but you're getting, I mean, that's his character. His character
is who he is.
That's
not who he is.
But I do.
That's not who he is.
Well, you don't think that's who he is when he's on stage?
It's a part of who he is.
He doesn't hang around with Lollipop Johnson and solve crimes. He never fucked the girl in Doggy Style because that's just how she passed out.
But we all know.
I disagree with that one.
But we all know Dave off stage, and he's a real introvert, so it doesn't surprise me that he's not comfortable on stage in front of strangers.
Rick was trying to get in.
Regardless of why he's comfortable, he's not what we were describing as talking about yourself. He's not really doing that.
Right. Go ahead,
but I think what the grain of truth that does come through, no matter what kind of material you're doing, even if it's observational, is the point of view and that. But that emotion that is there, and that's the real thing we see. It's not exactly, you know, the stories or the jokes he's telling. We're seeing that real point of view. I mean, Louis Black is the sweetest man in the world off stage, but there's that little part of him that he says he lets the man out who comes out, the Tasmanian devil. That's really a part of him.
Yes, yes.
That he will never, in private conversation, he'll never let it out.
But it's
a grain of reality.
But you see the anger, and the anger comes from disenchantment and disappointment, generally, right, in like mankind.
And it also reflects ours. Yeah. He's our voice in that sense. So,
yeah.
God, you know.
Also, you've got to do something that other people aren't doing. If I just kept it real, if you will, what am I going to say that hasn't been said? I guess I have. I mean, my life experience is not that weird or different.
Yes, it is. Your life experience is pretty unique to the people that I know, and your point of view. And when you tell me stories about your life, I find them pretty interesting, and I see how they could be interesting
to an audience. You may be right. Well, but you know what? What's the difference? I've been written off anyway.
Oh, that's so not true.
Well, yes, it is.
Can I tell one story?
That's why I have to go to Quebec or France.
Can I tell one thing about Attell? Just one. This is why he's so interesting. Years ago, we were playing at some club, me, him, and John Stewart, and it was called, I think it was called Rectangles on like 14th and 2nd
The Yemenite restaurant?
Yeah. And because they had glass windows. Yeah. So we were sitting outside, you know, smoking or talking, whatever it was, and you can only see inside Attell sitting there with the microphone, just his mouth moving, but you couldn't see what he was saying. And he was just sitting there so grouchy, and he was sitting on a stool, and he just looked so depressed. And then when I opened the door, the first thing I heard was, "So I told Elie Wiesel, lighten the fuck up." and that's where I was like,
"Isn't that a Jewish restaurant?
This guy's unbelievable."
My father hated Elie Wiesel.
By the way, your father hated Elie Wiesel too. he was on fire, your dad.
My father, Elie Wiesel got my father to utter one thing he never thought he'd say: "Enough with the Holocaust." He really did. Like, Jesus Christ, Elie.
Enough with it.
Enough already.
Well, how did him and Attell not like each other? They have the same material.
Gilbert Godfrey, by the way, is another guy who is very, doesn't have a honest.
Right. Excellent
and
point.
He may be one. He's one of my personal favorites.
But could you say those guys are all characters, maybe?
Wiesel. Godfrey especially is a character.
Yeah, and so is Attell, and so is Dangerfield. In a way, you know, I mean, can you say that if you're like a regular guy, you probably need to tell more about your. If you're a Tom Rhodes, it's more important for you to tell your life story.
You remember that old adage that the difference between a comic and a comedian is that a comic says funny things and a comedian says things funny.
Yeah, but nobody takes it serious.
Wait a minute. No, hold on. No.
It's
but
like there's like
time plus. Like if you do jokes from a point of view, but you don't tell me your life story, I think that you're more of a comic. You're telling, you know, like Rodney Dangerfield was a comic.
Well,
you know,
listen,
Phyllis Diller was a comic. Who's doing one-liners now?
I'll tell you that,
listen, obviously, there's not one size fits all. That's the problem. And it's easy to make excuses.
What I want to say is that we're talking about the personal stories now, things coming from a more human reality TV point of view that compels us all to follow that story. And I think that would be the style now that we're craving more than just the jokes. But both of them are valid.
What's the name of the guy who does impressions that we had on the show?
Dave Juskow.
No.
Hey, are you sure?
No, he's on Stern.
Craig Gass.
He's amazing.
So he does amazing impressions, right? And we put him on, and it didn't go that well.
Yeah, he's a strange guy, but on the show he was brilliant. So
I tried to talk to him, but the backstory to him is he was raised by two deaf parents.
Is that right?
And he learned to speak by watching television.
So why doesn't he talk about that?
That's
what I'm getting at. And that's where the whole impression thing, I'm like, Why are you not using that as your entree? It's one thing to do impressions on a Stern show.
Yeah, how did Stern not even get that out of
but
him?
But in a stand-up, comedy stage, I mean, I would, and so, like, when you have something that is gripping, you should use it. Natterman has stuff. I don't know Seinfeld's life. I don't know if we're missing out on Seinfeld.
The problem is, I've told you this a million times. The funny thing about Noam is, I say this with all due respect, somehow he thinks he knows more about comedy than I do. I would never presume to say I know more about music than you.
You understand this is just a dodge.
No, but I'm getting to what you're saying.
I don't say I know more about comedy than you.
I've told Noam a fucking million times, I cannot combine the jokes that I'm doing now. Noam seems to think I can do the jokes I'm doing now and then just talk normally
about
real shit.
But don't you have an experience?
You know nothing about comedy.
You can't
you're
combine
professional.
Them.
You're professional. Whoa. You can.
You know, you can't. If David Tell was like, so I was fucking her, that she said she passed out, and then he was like, yeah, so my father died and I really miss him.
That I agree with.
It wouldn't work.
That I agree with.
You can't fucking.
But what I am,
you're too smart. You're a University of Pennsylvania graduate. You can figure out, you can be the guy that figures it out.
If
Noam wants me to go in that direction, I would have to throw out all the shit that I've built over the years. I couldn't even work here because I don't have enough time to fill the 10-minute spots that I get here with the new shit that Noam wants me
to
do.
This is what I want
to
say. In the debate, when somebody says your name, you have the right to respond.
That's right.
Yes. I have the right to respond.
You have the right to respond. 3 minutes.
I know something better than you know, and actually you know it too in the reverse. I know better than you do how you come across to an audience. That is the one thing you performers never can be sure of, that I can tell you. And I know better than you do what comes out of your mouth that's interesting. And similarly, you know better than I do how I come across. So I'm trying to tell you, listen, I'm a pretty, you know, I see a lot of comics. I don't like dumb things. We usually agree in our tastes on matters of a third party. We usually think the same things are funny, the same, we're pretty alike in how we judge things aesthetically. So taking the fact that you can't really judge yourself, and B, that I have a taste which you usually agree with, you should say, you know what? Maybe there is something to what he's saying, because the guy,
No, I never said you were wrong.
Is that ridiculous?
I never said you were wrong, but I said many times that I couldn't combine the two, and that's where you disagreed with me, and that's what I disagreed with. If I did go the route that you're suggesting, which is be honest, talk more real, I would have to dump all the shit that
I'm saying. I'll say one more thing, sure, and I can turn it over and I'll stop saying. The way this actually started, just to remind you, was that I had noticed that the comedians who really were dominating in stand-up comedy were doing longer form material. And that doesn't only have to come from talking about yourself, but that very often that's what it involves. That the rapid-fire comics, while they have some success, they're not becoming the Louis C.K.'s or the Richard Pryor's or whoever's out there, even Bill Burr. You know, Bill Burr will do a 15-minute something on something. And so I was trying to encourage you to find a way to stretch out into longer things, because I know that you're... That you're tremendously talented and smart, and I'm not saying it would work or wouldn't work. I'm saying you don't even try. It's like you've decided, oh, this is what I am, and I'm never going to try anything else.
And can I just say something?
Now I'm done.
You get to the length, whatever the length is, based on what you're talking about, and Dan just may not be at a place where something happens to him in the middle of the day, an interaction, or somebody talks him a certain way, and he wants to bring that on stage and talk about it. Like, 12 hours after San Bernardino bombing, I got on a subway, and there were two women in full burkas, and I instantly thought they were terrorists. And I decided to talk about it on stage, and it's a little uncomfortable, but, like, if somebody's not ready to go there, he's got it, but he's got
to
be ready to go there.
I'm ready to go there, but I'm not. But no, you wouldn't use me if I did that, because I couldn't do it and make...
He's right about. You got to kill in the room in this place.
You wouldn't use me, because even if I decided to go in this direction that you're suggesting, it's basically like starting over. I'm repeat this because apparently, you know, maybe you didn't hear me the first time. I would have to dump all the shit I already have.
First of all,
what's wrong with that?
No,
not necessarily anything.
You could,
but this is how I make a living.
Louis did it.
Let me be something. Louis
was in a position to do it.
You could do your first 7 minutes that are very, very strong, and then experiment with a little bit of what we're talking about. And then if you find it wasn't going well, then maybe, you know,
that's a good point.
Punt. And then you could also go to some other clubs where you have more latitude to do it. You're right, I can't use you if you're not going over.
So why can't you do your, when you go on the road, you
also,
do your regular act for
I'm
now,
what
and then
I'm
you work
doing,
on the other stuff.
What I'm doing now is very, I mean, what you're suggesting, I guess, might be unique in a sense. What I'm doing now, I consider to be quite unique. I don't think it is. And so there, that has some value. Now, you suggested that people that are really making it huge are the Louis C.K. types, the people that just kind of go on there, and there's a preaching quality to it. There is a say it, brother, quality to it. You know what I mean?
You're right about that, and I don't like that so much, but you're right.
You know,
I don't know, Dan. I know we talk about this every time we're on the podcast, but it's kind of like the same thing on America's Got Talent when the judges are talking to you and we just want to hear more about you. Everybody was interested. Everybody was on your side. We just want to hear more.
Well, when did I not? I don't want to talk about America's Got Talent.
I know. I'm sorry.
But first of all, I don't know what you're saying.
Just people want to know more about you.
When did I not talk about me?
Like when the judges are talking to you, they're just giving you criticism and you're not being Dan. You're not doing this and being like, what do you know about, you know, you're German, you're Nazi, you know?
Well,
I don't believe he said Nazi.
When I'm in front of live television, in front of 10 million people, I don't see it coming. It's kind of hard to be Dan. That is Dan Natterman in that situation. A deer in the headlights.
I guess it's just Howard Stern, you make too much of that.
That damn stupid America's Got Talent.
I know, I do. I know, because I was just rooting for it. But it's the same thing that everybody just wanted more.
I know. Who's everybody?
Out.
Everybody wanted
Howard
more.
Howard Stern talked about it like every day when you were on.
Well, if he loved me so much, he's never had me on his shows. He didn't love me that much. And the people at home didn't vote for me enough, so they didn't love me that much or want to hear more. So,
on that note.
Sorry.
Yeah, we have a lot of stuff to. How much time have we done?
We're at an hour.
We've done three shows.
Hour and 20 minutes.
Good. Now, you know.
Listen, Dan. We all love you and see.
That's a fact.
And see talent.
Well, we all love Dave Jeskow too.
Yes.
The problem is neither of us are going anywhere.
It's true.
I mean, what's this? Can we all be at that level? Can we all be at that Louis level? I mean, that.
No, we can't all be at that Louis level.
I don't understand what the big problem is. About, so you're a great comedian and direction.
Here's the problem: is that I can't do comedy clubs anymore. And if
why
I just can't do it psychologically, I can't do it. I just can't.
No, I understand.
Hang on a second. You mean just being on the road?
I can't do it. I get anxious. I just hate the environment. By the way, I'll be at the Stress Factory this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. I will be. And I don't want to go.
We have to wrap it up because we're already way over. We're going to have to.
Most of this will be lopped off anyway, I think.
Not this part. Anyway, congratulations, guys, on your success with The Godfather tonight.
You were amazing.
Thank you.
Really
you
amazing.
It really brought another thing to it. Yeah. It was really great.
I agree. And,
and show business is stupid. Can we all agree with that? It's a stupid business.
If mother hugged us two more times, we wouldn't be doing this.
Right. Kids, if you're listening at home,
I was a kid. I was starry-eyed. You know, and like so many of us. But,
me too. Do you think?
Yes, I know it's the same for everybody.
You're an attorney, Dan. I'm an attorney, and I practiced. And I had several people recently, for some reason, say to me, man, your life seems so great and cool. And these are like pretty rich lawyers who like feel like they're just kind of marching to the same beat. And I don't necessarily feel that way about myself. And I look at them and go, man, well, that would be nice to maybe not have to worry. So the grass is always greener. And, you know, we may not have sort of monetary gains that we want, but, you know, we might be living a life that a lot of people envy. Not that we judge by other people's opinion, but.
Yeah, but I think what Dan is saying is that, like, if the Lord could come down and guarantee Dan, look, you're not going to be a star, but it's not going to get any worse than it is now. Mm-hmm. You're like, okay. What he's saying is that 2 years from now, I got no guarantee it won't get much worse, except that now I'm going
to
be
in my mid-40s, and then what do I do? We all have to have the intestinal fortitude to fight through that concern. Yeah. That's the bottom line. We all have it.
But Noam is exactly, by the way, encapsulated it perfectly. Yeah. Yes, because you just don't know.
But look what we get to do. I mean, so it's, you know, are you going to go back to the office? No, you're not. That's not an option.
Bend over.
All right, on that note.
I don't know, maybe I've had too much to drink.
You see Dan Natterman, was this weekend?
I'll be at the Stress Factory. Yeah, Vinny tells me that the tickets are, you know, we still have some left.
Is it okay if I throw something out
there? Yes,
May
please.
21st, I'm in the New York City Podcast Festival. And
I'm on before him.
Saturday night, is it at the Cake Shop? Just different podcasts are part of this festival over the course of 2 or 3 days. My guests are John Fugelsang and John Batiste from the Colbert Show. And it's at 9:45 at the Cake Shop, but Dave's also got
mine's at 3 in the afternoon. At the Cake Shop. It's called this Podfest thing.
It's New York City Podfest.
What's the Cake Shop?
Exactly.
It's a small venue, like a, just a, you know, like a, they have music there or comedy.
They called me, they say, you have zero ticket sales. And I'm like, I told you.
A competitor?
No.
Oh, no.
No, it's not a comedy.
You're plugging a podcast at comedyseller.com.
Podcast at comedyseller.com. We want your feedback.
I would just like to say to everyone a good night.
The next Godfather, August 2nd.
August 2nd, The Godfather.